fantastic leader. Margaret Thatcher turned out to be a fantastic leader. So I just hope that whoever is elected does take that job on board and does a great job, because quite frankly there's a huge amount to go at with the Labour Party, and I knew they would implode, but within 3 months, I mean, even they have surpassed their incredibility.
Great stuff, thank you all. Really interesting. We'll return to this one.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Harvey Cook. Experts are appealing for people to come forward if they think their relatives may have been buried at a mother and baby home in Ireland. The nuns who ran the home at Tuam in County Galway between the 1920s and 60s disposed of up to 796 babies and young children in a disused sewage tank. A new excavation of the site is aiming to identify the victims. Daniel McSweeney, who's in charge of the project, says there's no guarantee of success.
We don't know, for example, how much DNA will be recoverable from remains that have been in the ground for 60, 70, 80 years. Remains that are identified will be returned to families so that they can bury them themselves. Remains that are not identified, I mean, there will be a burial of those remains, but I think memorialisation goes beyond that. And I think that's where we need to talk to families and discover, well, how actually do you want these people to be memorialised and in what way?
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has said 100,000 people have left Lebanon for Syria due to the recent Israeli airstrikes. Overnight, Israel widened its operations, and there are fears tanks may soon cross the border into Lebanon. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega, who's in Beirut, has been following developments.
An Iranian-backed militant group, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, said three of its leaders were killed as a result of this strike that hit a residential building in the Kola area. And this morning, Hamas said its leader in Lebanon was killed in an Israeli airstrike in southern Lebanon. So it seems these are indications that the Israeli military is expanding its campaign in Lebanon beyond Hezbollah.
Preparations are underway to close the last coal-fired power station in the UK today. Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire first started production in 1968. When the plant closes tonight, the UK will become the first major economy to stop using coal. The Shadow Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has warned his fellow Conservatives not to fall into what he called the trap of believing people will get fed up with Labour and automatically return to the Tories. Speaking at the party's conference in Birmingham, he also said the Conservatives have got themselves in a position at July's general election where they were seen as part of the problem rather than the solution when it came to dealing with the issues facing the UK. Barbara Streisand and Dolly Parton are among the celebrities to have shared their memories of Kris Kristofferson, who's died at the age of 88. The family of the country singer and actor said he died at his home in Hawaii on Saturday. Among his most famous songs were Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Bob Harris, the host of Radio 2's Country Show, said Kris Kristofferson was great because he was so genuine.
He was always just himself. And I think that was fantastic. And even fairly recently, he did a gig. Introduced him, actually, the gig. This was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And he was still, I mean, absolutely still so charismatic.
Bob Harris on Kris Kristofferson, who's died at the age of 88. And that's the BBC News at 3 minutes past 11.
With the 5 Live Sport, I'm Shojo Sarkar. Hampshire have signed a deal with Delhi Capital's co-owners, the GMR Group, to finalise a takeover of the County Championship Club. It'll make Hampshire the first county to be owned by an overseas franchise. GMR will take an immediate majority stake and then aim to complete a 100% takeover in the next 2 years. France forward Antoine Griezmann has announced his retirement from international football at the age of 33. The Atletico Madrid player made 137 appearances for France and helped them win the World Cup in 2018. And in women's rugby union, Ireland secured a sensational last gasp 29-27 win over the world champions New Zealand in their opening WXV1 match in Vancouver.
On BBC iPlayer.
Marcus Calderwood identified me before he died.
Why did he identify you?
I don't know.
A cop who smashed his car into a guy trying to save the planet.
Allegedly, he's still entitled to a defence.
I don't think we should touch this.
Starring Michael Socca and Adil Akhtar.
Before we go to court, is there anything I need to know?
The new series of Show Trial.
I'm Officer X.
Watch all episodes from this Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Nagam and Chetty.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past 11, Monday the 30th of September. I do hope you are well. Great to be with you. Not so happy about the weather, I will say. Rainy, to say the least. but I think it is for most people. Perhaps you're in a pocket of sunshine. If you are, let me know. That'd cheer me up. That'd be great. I don't need cheering up, but it is nice when the sun's shining, for me, anyway. We have a lot to get through over the next 3 hours. It's a good job we have 3 hours. We're going to start with the situation in the Middle East. The conflict between Israel and Iran's allies seems to be spreading rapidly. So, latest developments I'll bring to you. I'm also going to talk to a British mother who's currently in Beirut with her young family, desperate to return home. I'll talk to her about what it's like being there right now. Here in the UK, a significant moment. The traditional way of steelmaking is going to end in Wales, and the last remaining blast furnace in Port Talbot will stop producing steel. The closure is part of a restructuring that will see 2,800 jobs cut, and future steelmaking in South Wales will rely on imports until an electric furnace is built. What's it like if you live or work in the area? And if it holds a special place for you, tell me about Port Talbot. Tell me about it and how you think it will change with this restructuring. You can get in touch. 850-58 is the number to text. You can call WhatsApp 08085 909 693. Get in touch via social media at BBC5Live. Now, tonight there is a panorama on, and my colleague Kirsty Walk is presenting it. It's called Panorama, the Menopause Industry Uncovered. And it's taking a look at private clinics and the way they prescribe hormone replacement therapy, HRT. And of course, women's health and issues around women's health are something that we cover on this programme regularly. Now, we're going to talk about some of the issues this panorama has raised. I have watched it. It is fascinating. It's on tonight. But today, I'll be joined by consultant endocrinologist Dr. Anise Mukherjee, who specialises in hormone-related conditions. Now, she's not going to give any direct medical advice, but she will be able to explain if you have a question about, say, why am I being given oestrogen and not progesterone, or why am I given progesterone and only this amount of oestrogen, or why am I not being offered testosterone? She'll be able to explain if you are interested in HRT or struggling with your HRT balance. She'll be able to explain the rules and regulations around how much can be given, the guidelines that doctors follow, and how you can ask questions or suggest alternatives to your doctor, or just be able to discuss alternatives with your doctor if you feel it's necessary. So you can get in touch as well. 850-58 is the number to text. So that will be from 11:30 in the next half hour. Now, it's 7 minutes past 11. Lebanon's prime minister has said that as many as 1 million people may have been displaced from their homes following the continuing airstrikes by Israel. The country's health ministry reported more than 50 people were killed in Sunday's strikes, 2 days after Israel assassinated Hezbollah leader Nassan Nasrallah in Beirut. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has fired more rockets into northern Israel. Can you imagine what it's like on the ground in Beirut? Well, Victoria Lupton doesn't need to. She's there with her daughter and her husband. She's British and due to get on a flight to Athens on Wednesday. Victoria, hello.
Hi there, Naga. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for talking to me. Whereabouts are you? Where have you been living? What were you doing in Beirut? And how long have you been there since the strikes have been happening?
So I founded an NGO that works in Lebanon and Jordan almost 10 years ago, and I spend a couple of months every year in Lebanon. We came 2 weeks ago, 2 Tuesdays ago, to Lebanon, and while we were on the flight, the pager explosions happened. So I came with my husband, my three-year-old daughter, it's actually her birthday today, we were on the flights when it happened, and then, you know, fairly soon after that started trying to look for flights out.
Wow. I mean, how old's your little girl? 3, did you say?
She's just turned 3, yes.
Just turned 3, and it's her birthday today.
It is, yeah. We tried to pull together and have a small gathering for her yesterday, but obviously it was difficult with everything happening around us. There was a constant sound of drone overhead, which we were trying to sort of drown out with some music. There is our sirens constantly all hours of the day. You know, I can hear both of those right now. And there are explosions all the time. You know, there's a few explosions every day.
How's she reacting?
I think I'm lucky that she's young. Lebanese friends I have who have much older children say it's really difficult to explain to them what's going on with with my daughter, it's really a question of trying to keep her away from windows, sing her songs. You know, I tell her that the explosions are fireworks. Unfortunately, she doesn't know any better for the moment.
Well, thank goodness. Hey, you don't want memories like that for her. How much of a struggle has it been to try to get out?
It has been quite difficult. We booked our flight a week ago, and we had to wait 8 days until we could go to Athens. They haven't, you know, there weren't direct flights to the UK for weeks. It's been quite frustrating because the UK government has really been pushing British citizens in Lebanon to leave without really providing any options for how to do so. So that has caused quite a lot of alarm for my family back at home, quite a lot of alarm for British people in Lebanon as well.
You work for an NGO, and although, look, it may feel like it, it may not. Fortunately, you're going to be able to get out, but I can imagine you know lots of people who aren't going to be able to leave and who are looking around and seeing the devastation and wondering what next.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the main point here. We have a country where everybody is living in terror because every day, you know, the Israeli government announces new targets. Last night, there was a target which was not even a Hezbollah area in central Beirut. It's the first time that that's happened. You know, that means that any area might be targeted. And if you're unlucky enough to be in that area, then you're just collateral damage. So I think that's what's really scary for people. In terms of my team, I have a team of about 85 people. I have colleagues in the Bekaa, in South Lebanon, in the southern suburbs. All of those areas have been targeted. I have many colleagues, many beneficiaries who have been displaced. Some of them have been displaced for a second time. You know, this escalation only started a week ago. And some colleagues have already moved to one village to seek shelter, and then that village was targeted, so they've had to move again. One participant in my NGO has had many, many members of her families killed, and the house next door to her was completely destroyed because of an Israeli rocket. So it's, you know, it's really very scary times, and the streets are just full of displaced people, Syrians, Lebanese. You know, yesterday I was going to do the groceries, and a young man came up to me. To my whole family. He's from a village called Shwayfet, which is 30 minutes away from Beirut. He told me that his house was destroyed on Wednesday in an Israeli attack. His factory closed, so he's lost his job as well, and he's now just sleeping on the streets. People's lives have been completely upturned in the space of a night.
What does it look like when you go to the supermarket, for example? What does it look like around you?
Well, I'm in a Christian suburb of Beirut, which for the moment is not being targeted, so it's quite quiet where I am. But certain streets, which are the more main streets, you have hundreds of people lying on the sides of the road. A lot of them don't even have mattresses because you know they'll have got an evacuation order from Israel in the dead of night. They'll have had to leave within 10 minutes with nothing but the clothes on their back. There are a lot of children around, you know, children and babies who are living on the streets. And they're the lucky ones that have not been killed by Israeli rockets.
How do you feel about leaving?
Very, very mixed emotions, to be honest. You know, a big part of me didn't want to leave. I'm leaving because of my daughter and family back home. But, you know, my heart is with all of my colleagues in Lebanon and my beneficiaries and friends who are not able to leave and who have no idea what the next few weeks are going to bring. You know, it's only been going 2 weeks since the Pedro explosions, and every day feels like a month at the moment. So, you know, even the areas that feel safe right now, there's very little telling what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
When people talk to you and they talk about Hezbollah and they talk about Israel, what are they talking about?
People in Lebanon or I think everybody is you know, this is the politically Lebanon's a politically divided country, but the national government has called 3 days of mourning for the death of Nafas and Nasrallah. To give you an idea, on Friday night there were 85 bombs dropped on the southern suburbs of Beirut at the same time, and those bombs sounded like they were happening right underneath my house. That's the explosions that killed Hassan Nasrallah. He was a divisive figure in Lebanon. Especially, you know, he opposed the Lebanese uprising in 2019. He intervened in Syria on behalf of Assad. But I think most Lebanese people are absolutely disgusted by the politics of assassination, the civilian deaths that go with it, and, you know, are standing united to say that there must be a ceasefire the international community has to intervene. This madness has got to stop and Israel has to be held to account.
It's been so interesting talking to you. Victoria, I wish you and your family safety, above all, and a safe journey home. And, of course, all of your colleagues, everyone, actually. I think the world watching agrees this is horrific and it's got to stop. I'm going to talk about the diplomatic consequences of that now. Victoria Lupton lives in Beirut with her daughter and husband, due to fly back to, fly to Athens on Wednesday to get out of the city. Thank you very much for your time with me on Five Live.
Is there a way to listen back to it?
Of course. You get off the line. My producer, Alison, will have a chat with you and she'll give you all the details. Right, worry not.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. It's interesting that Victoria ended on that note that there has to be some diplomatic solution. There has to be some international intervention. Yeah, okay. Who's going to dive in and who's going to actually make a difference? How has this situation come about, first of all? And the Middle East is such a powder keg. And the fear is, I mean, this looks like escalation. This is escalation, but how much more escalation can we expect? These aren't the questions I can answer. When I can't answer questions like this, I get our diplomatic correspondent, Caroline Hawley, to join me in the studio to give me her big brain. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll try my very best.
Well, I'm sure you're very best.
It's a complicated situation.
It so is. You know, I was talking about this morning in our meeting, and I thought one maybe clearer way of going about it, rather than just going through all the political factions, was literally let's talk about what Lebanon is like now, who's there, what kind of place it is, and then let's talk about the countries around it, because that's how we kind of try to figure out who's influencing what. So in terms of Lebanon, Victoria was saying it's a melting pot, isn't it?
It is a melting point. Hezbollah has had grown under the leadership of Hassan Nasrallah into a state within a state, extremely powerful militarily and politically. And now it's taken this hammering, the sort of hammering that really began with those extraordinary attacks, simultaneous attacks on Hezbollah operatives through pagers and walkie-talkies, you may remember, on the 17th and 18th.
Of course.
A huge coup for Israeli intelligence after the massive failings on October the 7th that led to October the 7th.
Which was Hamas, though.
That was Hamas. That's a whole different thing.
Yes, exactly.
And that is the sort of festering sore, or the Israel-Palestine situation is the festering sore, which is the problem that leads to so many repercussions across the Middle East. So that's why diplomats have been so busy trying to talk about a ceasefire in Gaza that they think could have prevented possibly what we're seeing now, but that obviously led nowhere. And frankly, diplomacy now seems dead. I mean, it's the guns that are talking.
Why? Lebanon's full of so many different types of people with so many cultural differences, religious differences. Why is it such a target? Is it simply because of Hezbollah?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yes, exactly. The Israelis are going after Hezbollah infrastructure. They're going after the arsenal. And most importantly, they are going after the senior leadership, including, obviously, Hassan Nasrallah, who you may be about to get on to this. But the other key country we need to talk about is Iran.
Well, let's go there. Let's go there, because Iran supports Hezbollah, correct?
Iran supports Hamas. Iran supports Hezbollah. Iran supports the Houthis in Yemen, all of whom have been involved in action over the past year. And you probably know that there were Israeli airstrikes on Yemen last night. So, I mean, the Middle East is an absolute tinderbox. It is, as you said, a power keg. The question is, what happens now?
Before you get to that, why does Iran support those factions?
Oh, it's such a good question. It's resistance to America and Israel is in the DNA of the Islamic Republic. It has these proxies or groups that it supports. Some people say they're not exactly proxies, to basically wield its influence in the region. And they call it the Axis of Resistance. That's what they call it. And it's been delivered an absolute hammer blow because Hezbollah was the most important arm of this so-called Axis of Resistance. So what does Iran do now? What did Iran do when the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran at the end of July? It said there would be revenge, but it's interesting. After the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, we heard the Supreme Leader talk, but he said, he suggested that any revenge would come through, or retaliation would come from Hezbollah itself. I don't think Iran wants to get involved in any kind of direct war with Israel, because that would involve the US coming in, other Western countries coming in. And Iran is in an interesting position. It's you may remember the Woman Life Freedom demonstrations. The regime is extremely unpopular, mm-hmm. and I think it feels that any involvement by it in a direct war could possibly be existential. So you'll hear words of, you know, there should be revenge, but will Iran actually do something itself? That would be a huge escalation in what we're seeing already, bad enough as it is. But all the indications at the moment are that Iran does not want to do that.
Okay, I'm going to put Iran in one corner because I've got a thought there. Mm-hmm. Can we look at the other neighbours? Can we talk about Syria? So I heard that there was, there was dancing in the streets when there was news of this Hezbollah leader being killed because of the links with Al-Assad. Explain this now,
okay,
Caroline.
There was dancing in some streets, okay. Not all streets, because There was a rebellion, a failed rebellion against President Assad, who is from a Shia sect called the Alawites. And there was an uprising, and it was mostly Sunni Muslims involved in that uprising. This was in 2011, Arab Spring. So Hezbollah got involved with Iran and Russia in propping up the government of President Assad. So the handing out sweets that you saw on some streets was in the streets of the north of the country, where the sort of last, which are the last rebel strongholds, and among Sunni Muslims. Now, interestingly about Hassan Nasrallah as well, I was once in Beirut years ago, and I was speaking to a Christian man who said that he supported Hezbollah, and I was gobsmacked, and I said, why? And he said, because Hezbollah is resisting Israel. So there are a lot of very kind of complex feelings about Hezbollah, not just in Syria, but in Lebanon as well.
Has Syria got an influence over what happens with Lebanon or Israel, with anyone?
Well, it did. It used to. It used to be basically the main influence in Lebanon, but no longer really. And you may remember that millions of Syrians fled the war
yes.
there. Now the direction of refugees is going in the opposite direction. So we're hearing from the UN that 100,000 Lebanese have gone to Syria. Now, when the streets of Beirut are full of Syrians who escaped the war there earlier. There have been airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in Syria, but I don't think the Syrian government's got any appetite to take on Israel at the moment either, just like Iran. But I think the fear is, I mean, you know, diplomats can scurry around, but really it is the guns that are talking at the moment. And so many, over the past few months, so many sort of red lines in the conflicts between Israel and Iran have been blown away. They've been trampled. And so it's really uncharted territory. There's so many unprecedenteds at the moment. I mean, that unprecedented Hamas attack on Israel, and then the war in Gaza that's caused more than 40,000 deaths.
And Israel's been focusing on Gaza. So the fact that it now is showing no sign of stopping when it comes to Lebanon, yet it still has Gaza in its mind to deal with, how is it, you know, which is its focus? Or is it just both, just to hammer them both?
I think it's the focus is on Israel now. I think it's done a lot of hammering in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hamas is certainly weakened. I think the bigger fear is you can decapitate an organization, but what comes next? So when Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, was assassinated in Tehran, a man called Yahya Sinwar took over the group, and he is more hardline. And back to Lebanon, I remember a former colleague of mine saying that every time the Israelis have gone after Palestinian militants, and we're not talking Palestinian militants, but we're talking Lebanese militants. But every time Israel has gone after militants in Lebanon, they've got a more dangerous iteration. So I think that's the fear. That's what people worry about, that where does this end? I mean, already the consequences of what's happened are going to last for generations. So much of Gaza already destroyed. And actually, I recently came back from Italy meeting two little girls who were injured in Gaza, and their injuries will be lifelong. I mean, every airstrike you're seeing in Beirut, you're going to see people killed, you're going to see people injured, and you're going to see people who will live with the consequences for the rest
maimed.
Of their lives.
Yeah.
Maimed. I mean, the little girl I met in Italy, she had fled her home, which is now destroyed. She'd gone from Khan Yunis to Rafah, and then she was from Rafah in Al-Mawasi. She was in a tent there. She wasn't feeling very well, so her mum had cooked her lentil soup. There was an airstrike nearby. She ran up into her mother's legs. The soup poured all down her. And I'm hearing from aid agencies that there are quite a lot of those kind of injuries happening in the tents now. So you've got a kind of catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza, and now a growing humanitarian disaster in Lebanon as well, with Lebanese officials talking about a million people having been displaced.
One more question on Israel, actually, before I go back to Iran. Netanyahu, how empowered is he? How much longer can he do this? Because his own government is, and his own party is challenging him at this moment in time. It's like he's trying to show he has the force, but I don't know if the will's behind him.
It feels like he's on a kind of military roll at the moment.
Because there are protests in the streets in Israel.
Yes, but my understanding, and I'm not there, so take this with a pinch of salt, my understanding is that what Israel is doing in Lebanon is much more popular than what the war in Gaza. Partly because so many Israelis have been affected and will continue to be affected by the border war with Hezbollah, tens of thousands of people displaced. And the whole kind of war aim in Lebanon is to enable Israelis to go back to their homes in the north of the country. But then, obviously, in Gaza, there were hostages. And I think a lot of people were really concerned about the hostages and thought that the priority of any Israeli government should be to get those hostages out. And that's why there was this huge demand for a ceasefire there that would enable the hostages to be released and to alleviate the suffering of Gazans. But my understanding was that the war in Lebanon is more popular.
So that could empower him, politically. Yeah, we spoke about Iran. I just put it in a corner. I'm going to bring it back into the room. Iran hates the US. Fair?
Hates Israel and the US. One is called the Little Satan. One is called the Big Satan. And you'll see on the streets of Tehran flags to suggest that and murals to suggest that. Although recently, with the rebellion and the Woman Life Freedom movement, some of those have been trampled on. I understood as well that many ordinary Iranians were, if not handing out sweets, quietly celebrating the death of Hassan Nasrallah, because they're furious. Their economy is in tatters. And yet Iran is kind of lavishing money on these proxy groups to wield its regional influence. So there are many Iranians who were not at all sad at the death of Hassan Nasrallah.
So then this turns back to, I'm assuming the United States is Big Satan, to what Big Satan, as Iran would call it, is going to do diplomatically to stop what is happening now. And what are we seeing?
Well, I think at the moment we are seeing efforts, but to no avail. I mean, don't forget that the order for the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah was given from Netanyahu's hotel room in New York, where he was attending the UN General Assembly, where diplomats were running around trying to get a 21-day ceasefire in Lebanon so that then they could buy themselves time to try to maybe bring about a ceasefire in Gaza, because Hezbollah got dragged into fighting Israel when the war on Gaza began. So it's all fantastically complicated and fantastically dangerous, and it's a very unpredictable moment. But certainly it looks like Israel is intent on smashing Iran's proxies in the region. And Iran at the moment is wondering what to do. It recently elected a more moderate president, Masoud Pezeshkian. And as I understand it, there's been quite a lot of debate between the conservatives and hardliners and the moderates about what to do next. But I think the supreme leader, people say, is kind of essentially cautious, and he feels that getting involved in any direct way would bring an awful lot of trouble down on his head and could be existential.
I have learnt so much. Thanks, Caroline.
Well, you're welcome.
I have, and I like this. I like this. The snippets. I didn't know Netanyahu was in that hotel room when it was ordered. I didn't know that had happened, and the big Satan, little Satan, all those things. But I've definitely learnt so much about how it all fits in, a lot more. Thank you.
Well, I may have made some mistakes. It's a fantastically complicated but important region, yeah. And we all watch what happens next.
That is why Caroline Hawley is our diplomatic correspondent. Thank you so much. If you do want to keep across the day's headlines, of course, and this is a developing story, a fantastically worrying story, you can do so with the live news stream on BBC Sounds. You can go to the dial at the top of BBC Sounds, look for live news. The time now is 11:31. I think we should catch up with what's going on in the news and the sport. And Richard Foster is going to pick up on what Caroline and I have been discussing. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Naga. Precisely that, yes. Hezbollah's deputy leader says it's ready for an Israeli ground offensive as Israel continues airstrikes across Lebanon. It's the first speech by one of the group's top officials since its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, died in an airstrike on Friday. Naim Qassem says the battle may be long. Experts are appealing for people to come forward if they think their relatives may have been buried at a mother and baby home in Ireland. The nuns who ran the home at Tuam in County Galway between the 1920s and 60s disposed of up to 796 babies and young children in a disused sewage tank. The Chancellor, the Shadow Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says Conservatives shouldn't fall into the trap that people will automatically return to the party when the Labour government becomes unpopular. He's told the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham that they must focus on the country and not on themselves. And Britain will become the first major world economy to stop using coal to generate power later. The Ratcliffe-on-Soar power station in Nottinghamshire is closing at midnight. It's been generating electricity for the last 56 years.
Richard, thanks very much for that. Interesting, that energy, the whole issue of energy and coal power generation, particularly on a day we're talking about Port Talbot. Richard, thanks. Shojo Sarkar, hello.
Good morning.
Now, I know you're going to get onto this row about Erik ten Hag. I know that's been spoken about a lot.
Yeah.
But are you going to talk about some business happening, some business deals in the sport?
I am actually, because cricket, we're set for something very new. Hampshire are to become the first county to be owned by an overseas franchise after agreeing a takeover deal by the Indian group GMR, who co-own the Delhi Capitals, the IPL team. This is going to be a phased acquisition to be completed over the next 24 months. And, you know, it could be a big deal. So they're going to be the majority shareholder straight away, and then they're looking to buy out 100% of Hampshire County.
And this is the first county team.
Yes.
So, I don't know, am I wrong to kind of... Okay, I probably am.
Go on.
So we're used to, like, football teams being owned by foreign owners.
Yes.
But cricket, that's just not cricket.
Well, it looks like it will be cricket because the deal is reported to be worth around £120 million. How accurate that is, but it'll be sort of ballpark, I should think. But yeah, I mean, we hear about county cricket being in desperate need of money, although Hampshire do have a test ground. Test grounds do bring in a lot more revenue as well in the summer. But, you know, we've seen a rift in the game over the last few years with the 100 going to some of the bigger counties, some of the minor counties, you know, desperate to have some of that revenue as well. So we shall see. It is a big deal. It's a landmark deal. Meanwhile, the England interim white ball coach, Marcus Trescothick, says only small margins determine the outcome of their ODI series against Australia. The tourists won the deciding fifth ODI by 49 runs in a rain-affected match in Bristol. The former England batsman Nick Compton believes there are positives to take from that series.
Jofra Archer, for me, is the exciting point, or the real positive. I mean, a man that's been out with injury, we know what he can do, and to see him bowl some of the deliveries at some of the pace that we've seen in the past was very good.
Manchester United boss Erik ten Hag says he's not thinking about the club's owners opting for a change of manager and claims they are all on one page. United were beaten 3-0 by Tottenham at Old Trafford and currently are sitting 12th in the Premier League. However, ten Hag plans to shake off yesterday's performance before their trip to play Porto in the Europa League this Thursday.
There's always a new day, and we will learn from it. And my players are strong characters, and they will bounce back. But we have to learn from this situation, from this afternoon, say in 4 days. A defender of the opponent can so travel over the whole pitch without be stopped. So we have to learn from this, and quickly.
Meanwhile, Tottenham say they will take the strongest possible action over abhorrent homophobic chanting from their fans at Old Trafford. Tottenham say it was hugely offensive and no way to show support for the team. The France forward, Antoine Griezmann, has announced his retirement from international football at the age of 33. The Atletico Madrid player made 137 appearances for his country, helped them win the World Cup as well in 2018. In rugby union, the opening weekend of the women's WXV1 tournament ended with Ireland pulling off a stunning upset against the world champions New Zealand. The Irish won that 29-27 in Vancouver with a final minute try and conversion. The Ireland captain is Adele McMahon.
We believe in what we're doing. We believe in the connections that we have with each other. We believe in the staff. We work really, really hard off pitch. We work even harder on pitch. We're competing every training session. So that's, you know, for us, that just validates exactly what we're doing. And we couldn't be more proud of the girls.
Well, the Black Ferns play defending champions England next on Sunday. England thrashed the USA 61-21. They've won 18 games in a row. British number one Jack Draper has withdrawn from this week's Shanghai Masters tennis following his retirement at the Japan Open over the weekend. Draper felt some discomfort in the abdomen, in this quarterfinal against Hugo Humbert. He's decided to focus on rest and recovery instead of playing in Shanghai. That is your latest from BBC Sport. Remember, you can listen at any time on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
Europe's elite club competition.
The Champions League. Right here on BBC Radio 5 Live. On Tuesday at 8.
Arsenal host PSG.
Right footed. This is saved by Raya. A fantastic goal save.
And on Wednesday at 8.
Aston Villa take on Bayern Munich.
Tielemans waiting. Control. Driven shot. Bottom corner.
And watch highlights of every single match with Match of the Day. Wednesday night on BBC iPlayer.
The Champions League.
On 5 Live. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Nagar Manchetti.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Good morning to you. 23 minutes to midday. Welcome back. Lots to come. Must watch from 1 o'clock. Clock. Hayley Campbell and Scott Bryan will be here to review the big television releases. Joan, Chris and Paddy's road tripping, and Ed Stafford are on the agenda today. We've also had the sad news over the weekend of the deaths of Maggie Smith, Beverly Hills Cop star John Ashton, of course, and we're going to reflect on those as well and just how actors can make a mark and kind of make you remember moments in life when you've had favourite films or TV series. So we'll talk a lot about that in Must Watch. That's all from 1 o'clock. Now, a story you may have heard or read on BBC News today is about women who say they've had medical issues after being prescribed high doses of oestrogen. So oestrogen is the hormone replacement, or the hormone that women take as a replacement to alleviate the symptoms of menopause. And in a handful of cases in question, some women have developed complications such as thickening of the womb lining. The stories are part of a BBC Panorama investigation into the multi-million pound global menopause industry. Now, that Panorama is on air tonight. Reporter Ruth Clegg has been taking a look at this. Ruth, morning to you.
Good morning, Naga.
Morning. So look, this programme, we often talk about the issues surrounding women's health. And we should say, and I think this is a brilliant thing, thank goodness we talk about menopause and it's not a word where someone goes, what? Huh? What's that? People know now, so that's great. We've spoken a lot and we know a lot about the treatments available for menopause. And that can only be a good thing, that we're talking about it more.
Absolutely. Thankfully, there is a lot more awareness and understanding of the menopause. It's less of a taboo subject. And GPs are more geared up and knowledgeable about how to treat women going through it and what options are available. And there's HRT, which is hormone replacement therapy, and that's undoubtedly been far more widely prescribed. And it is making things better for a lot of women across the UK. And there are things like workplace policies, more awareness in the workplace about the menopause. And on a whole, we're just less embarrassed about talking about such a major thing in women's lives. But there are some big buts. Now, the global menopause industry, it's virtually sprung up in the last 7 years, kind of overnight in some respects. And some women, they don't know what to believe. You hear so much about the menopause and everything from menopause pyjamas to chocolate that you can eat to all manners of different supplements. And some of these supplements can cost up to £100 a month. And what we've looked at with BBC Panorama is, do they always do what they say on the tin? So we worked with the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University, and it found there are 200 products on the market, so a wealth of different supplements and different things that women can take, and that's either in retailers or sold on what many of us see on social media. And bear in mind, women are bombarded every day with one product or another that promises, in some respects, to change their lives. So we worked with researchers and they did a deep dive into a small snapshot, 15 menopause products and the science behind their claims. And I suppose the question is, what did they find? Well, only one of those 15 products had been trialled to establish whether it was effective. That's just one. So there's not much evidence out there to back up some of the menopause industry's claims.
Okay, but it's not just supplements and high street products that Panorama looked at, because that's obviously one side and a massive growing industry.
Yeah.
But also it's looked at the way HRT is prescribed, not by NHS GPs, but by private clinics.
Yes, Panorama looks specifically at a private clinic called Newson Health. It's run by Dr. Louise Newson. She's seen as kind of one of the top TV menopause doctors. She often appears on television and radio. And undoubtedly, with HRT, there are huge benefits of taking it. It's been shown to be safe and effective at the maximum licensed dose, and that's 100 micrograms of oestrogen. But the safety of prescribing higher doses hasn't been established by clinical trials. To make clear, it's a very kind of nuanced grey area. The General Medical Council guidelines do allow specialists to prescribe above the licence if they think it might help a patient. Panorama has spoken to more than a dozen women who have been prescribed over the licensed dose of oestrogen by Newson Health, and they told us that they had experienced complications after treatment. Some women told us they were not told about potential risks of going over that maximum licensed dose. So in the BBC Panorama film, we hear from and we see Paula, Rachel and Ria, and they're all women who've had a very bad experience. And they tell us that as their symptoms got worse, the doctors at Newson Health were increasing the dose of oestrogen. Rachel, for example, was at one point on 300 micrograms. That's three times the licensed maximum amount. She developed new symptoms. Her original symptoms were getting worse, and she developed new symptoms like severe pelvic pain, and was diagnosed on the NHS with a condition called endometrial hyperplasia. And that's when the lining of the womb thickens, and it can be a precursor to cancer. We spoke to her NHS gynaecologist, and she attributes this high dose of oestrogen with, she says, not enough progesterone. Now, that's the other hormone in HRT that many women are prescribed, and it's used to protect the womb and to avoid those complications.
There were also some consultations that Panorama did with Newson doctors as using an undercover reporter. What happened then?
Well, to test what Newson Health doctors told the women, Panorama booked two remote consultations using an undercover reporter. Now, she posed as a menopausal woman, already on a maximum estrogen dose of 100 micrograms. What was striking about those consultations with the two Newson doctors is that while one of them did speak about nutrition and lifestyle, which is a really kind of positive thing to be talking about as contributory factors to menopausal symptoms, they both said it was not always necessary to stick to the licensed maximum dose. One of the doctors told our reporter, Dr. Newson is on 300 micrograms of oestrogen, and later reassured her that there isn't really any risk in going over, is basically what I'm saying.
What's Newson Health said?
Well, speaking on behalf of the doctors, Newson Health told Panorama there was nothing improper in either of those consultations and that proper processes were followed. Dr. Newson says there's no evidence to link higher doses to an increased risk of long-term health. She says harm is more likely to be caused by failing to give women the amount they need.
OK. We should say, has Newson Health, I mean, it is very well known and it has treated a lot of women.
Absolutely. And they've told the BBC they've helped more than 45,000 women since 2020, a lot of those through online consultations. There's no doubt that many women have been satisfied with their experience at Newson Health, and Dr. Newson has many high-profile supporters. In the course of our investigation, we have discovered that the health watchdog, the Care Quality Commission, is looking into information of concern at Newson Health. It told Panorama it was following up information it had received to understand, in its words, if there are any risks to people using the service and whether further action is warranted. Newson Health has responded to us, saying it has addressed all points raised by the watchdog and it has not been notified of any resulting concerns. It says it is confident in the quality of care it provides and maintains a CQC good rating. We also discovered that Dr. Newson is no longer accredited by the charity, the British Menopause Society, as a menopause specialist around high doses of prescribing HRT. In response to that, Dr. Newson told us that the British Menopause Society was a charity, not a regulatory body, and she is yet to receive a satisfactory response as to why her accreditation was removed. Newson Health told us it would not comment on individual cases. It says it operates a responsible audit practice to ensure patient safety and consistent levels of care. It also said it uses a wealth of clinical experience and data, as well as the available scientific evidence to treat patients on an individualised basis, and it does provide the best possible menopause care.
Ruth, thanks very much for that. Okay, so we've gone through what Panorama is looking at. Our reporter there, Ruth, has just taken us through that. It does raise a lot of questions when it comes to HRT. And anyone who's watching it, or watching that Panorama, it's on at 8 o'clock tonight, by the way, on BBC One. That's Kirsty Walk who's presenting that. So you may watch it and you may think... what's going on? Why don't I understand how these levels of HRT are being prescribed and who gets what and how it's determined? Well, Dr. Anise Mukherjee features in the programme. She is a leading UK hormone specialist, a speaker and author who specialises in optimising the quality of life when it comes to hormone problems. She's an endocrinologist, and often if you have certain hormone levels that need looking at, you are referred to an endocrinologist, or you can be asked to. Anise, Dr. Mukherjee, hello, good morning.
Good morning, Naga.
Morning. So I think the one thing that's going to come out of this is that people are going to say, well, maybe I've been prescribed more oestrogen, or I was told I could raise my estrogen intake if it's not working the first time I'm prescribed HRT? What should I be thinking?
So I think the first thing to say is that the licensed preparations of HRT we have today are safer than ever before. So anyone being prescribed HRT according to NHS and British Menopause Society guidelines, which are rigorously peer-reviewed and scrutinised and agree with all the international guidelines, any woman being treated in that way shouldn't be concerned. And it's good, actually, that more women are being prescribed HRT. But, you know, the problem is that a small group of women might need higher doses. And if you're prescribed a higher dose, you should be informed about the fact that there are not safety data with higher doses of estrogen, particularly if progesterone isn't adjusted in line with the estrogen. Because, you know, if you're not given that information, you might make decisions about your own care. You might think something's safe when it's not. So you might make decisions that you wouldn't have otherwise made.
Let me ask a question, though. If you say there's no safety data, is there any data to show that it isn't safe rather than there being no data to show that it is safe to take higher levels? Does that make sense?
Well, the way our modern healthcare systems work is that obviously patient safety is of paramount importance. So when a product, whether it's a hormone or not, gets a license, we look at safety data for all the doses that are licensed. We also look at the effectiveness, the efficacy data. And we know that the doses we have for the vast majority of women will be safe and effective. And those doses are found by very detailed dose finding studies. And, you know, there may be concerns about doses outside licensing. So we don't work on a principle that, you know, if we haven't got evidence of harm, let's just give as much as we want. You know, the natural label, even with hormones, doesn't guarantee safety.
How do you know if you've been prescribed above the maximum dose? Because estrogen comes in many forms, doesn't it? When you're given it, there's the pump gel, there's the patch, there are tablets,
and there are all of the products have very clear cut information for doctors about maximum licensed doses. So doctors know if they are going to be giving you a product that's outside a product license. And with any medicine that is prescribed, if you're being prescribed a medication, whether it's a hormone or not, off license, so that might be a higher dose than is licensed for a licensed preparation, or it might be a drug being used off license for a different condition. You should be informed of that if you're being given a drug that isn't licensed. And the NHS patients are GPs in the NHS very rarely use medications outside of licensing. Specialists sometimes do. As I've said, occasionally higher doses are needed, but not routinely, and not sort of mega doses, not, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times above the licensed dose. There's not, you know, safety data with those doses. And it's sort of intuitive that if you're going to be giving large amounts of estrogen, because estrogen thickens the womb lining, if you're not given enough progesterone, the womb lining is going to thicken. And we know from studies from 60 years ago, when estrogen was originally given without progesterone, that women developed endometrial thickening, hyperplasia and cancer, which is why we always use progesterone in women with a womb. And we understand the dose balance between those two hormones, which informs the licensing of these HRT products.
When you are prescribed HRT, estrogen with progesterone, what if you are told by your doctor, if you feel this hasn't made a difference, feel free to raise the dose? Pump more gel, for example.
Well, I mean, I think for anyone concerned who thinks they're being prescribed above the licensed dose, they need to ask their doctor.
It's a different question. I wasn't clear. Say you go to your doctor and you're prescribed progesterone, the pill, to protect the lining of the uterus, and then you're given the gel, the estrogen gel. And they say, right, we'll start with one pump. And what happens for anyone who's listening, you have one squeeze of the gel and then you can rub it on a part of your body, usually your legs, your thighs, or the tops of your arms. You avoid your breasts. One pump, and then you let it dry, let it absorb into the skin, crack on with the rest of your day. What if you are told then, look, if you feel this isn't making a difference, say within a week, 10 days, then feel free to add another pump. How confident should women be knowing that they can adjust their own levels? Because I know many people who have been told to do that.
Well, you can increase the estrogen dose up to middle to high range doses without necessarily increasing the progestogen that you're using. But there are different progestogens being used. So there's natural progesterone, which many women are going on to now. And then there are synthetic progestogens. So it kind of depends on what you're on. But within licensed doses, some women will be okay up to the middle range dose. But when you go up to the maximum dose, the progestogen might not be enough. And in fact, we have seen a big increase in vaginal bleeding, unscheduled bleeding on women in the last couple of years going on to HRT within licensed doses. Those women don't seem to have any serious complications associated with HRT within licensed doses, but it's often causing bleeding or pelvic pain. The concern really is when you go beyond the licensed dosing of the estrogen and you're not dosing enough with progesterone. But there has been a change in the guidance from a lot of the organising bodies in the UK because of all this unscheduled bleeding, that if women are going on to the highest dose of estrogen, they should have a higher dose of progesterone as well to balance the womb lining. So this is sort of a problem that we're seeing with the increased prescribing of HRT.
So women should make clear when they're receiving HRT prescriptions or advice that they know these doses?
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult for women. Women aren't doctors. They are reliant on their prescriber.
Exactly.
So it's the responsibility of the prescriber to share information. There are some uncertainties if you're going on to very high doses of hormones, and that should be shared. And then the doctor should then explain, well, why are we increasing the dose? Are we increasing the dose, you know, because perhaps doctor might say that you're not absorbing the estrogen enough and therefore you need a higher dose, but there should also then be a discussion about changing the delivery route. There's a number of different nuanced conversations that need to be had. And I think what we just need to be aware is that hormones are prescribable medications in HRT because they are classed as a medication. And no medication should be prescribed flippantly, assuming it's going to be safe, if there are not good safety data with some of the doses.
Anish, you're going to come back, aren't you? Because I'm getting texts already and questions, and very kindly you're giving me some of your time. I'm going to leave you with a thought, though, and you can have a thought back for this. I won't get your response now. But someone's message hasn't left their name. I'm appalled by this continued focus on menopause. I feel it may encourage women to seek unlicensed, unsafe medication. Menopause is not a disease. It's a fact of life and entirely natural. I may be old-fashioned, but just deal with it. I thought women were strong. Dr. Anise Mukherjee, you can mull over that text. I will speak to you in the next hour. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Before I go, I want to talk to you. It's a lovely story. When something precious has been lost and then returned a long time after. That's what happened to British fashion designer Jean Pallant, Jean Pallant, actually, she's not French, a coat she made at her kitchen table in 1988, went missing from her warehouse, been found in a charity shop. She says she's over the moon. It's a one-of-a-kind coat, orange with large black buttons. Sounds delightful. Pauline is one of the volunteers at that charity shop, the Oxfam shop in Mill Hill in North London, who spotted it and helped it reunite with its owner. And Pauline joins me now. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Tell me that when you found this garment, what did you think when you saw it?
Well, I'm of an age from the 60s, 70s and 80s. So I was very into fashion. And when it came in a black plastic bag, as most of our donations do. And when Marina, our manager, pulled it out, I said, oh, that's a beautiful coat. It looked absolutely brand new. And it was an orange colour. And the designer was Jean Pallant, so we decided to look her up. And the rest is history. She's we reunited the code with her.
When you got in touch with her, did she say that it was missing or had she given it away?
Yeah, she told us the story. We were amazed that it had been stolen from one of her lockups 40 years ago.
Ah, yes. So
and it came in brand new. Looking brand new. It's amazing.
Are you not allowed... Do volunteers not get first dibs on what's taken in to the
show? No, we don't do that. We get as much as we can for the charity.
So, okay, all right. When you gave it...
I would have loved the code.
I know, I was just thinking it sounds really, really lovely. Do you know what Jane's going to do with the coat? Do you know what she's going to do with it? Do you know what she's going to do with it, with the coat now?
Well, she's going to put it into her collection for the V&A.
Nice. Very, very, very nice.
Which I'd love to see it.
Oh, yeah, it would be absolutely stunning. And she must have been delighted.
Oh, she was amazed. After we reunited her coat after 40 years. Can you imagine?
What a great story. And you've told it to us on Five Live. Thank you so much, Pauline. Good spotting. Good, like...
You're welcome.
Sartorial glances. Thank you. Take care, Pauline. Makes me think if you've, like, ever lost something precious and it's come back just out of the blue. It's so lovely when that happens, isn't it? You know, when I think of Mondays, I do like a weekend win, and Claire's given me one in Berkshire, celebrating my husband's birthday today in between packing for our holiday to Tenerife tomorrow, looking forward to some sunshine and relaxing. Good for you. In the next hour, we'll have more with Dr. Anise Mukherjee and Must Watchers at One.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live at midday, I'm Richard Foster. Lebanon's Prime Minister says a million people may have had to leave their homes due to Israeli airstrikes. Hezbollah has fired more rockets into northern Israel in retaliation. Victoria Lupton lives in Beirut with her husband and 3-year-old daughter. She told Naga it's been difficult to leave.
We booked our flight a week ago and we had to wait 8 days until we could go to Athens. There weren't direct flights to the UK for weeks. It's been quite frustrating because the UK government has really been pushing British citizens in Lebanon to leave without really providing any options for how to do so. So that has caused quite a lot of alarm for my family back at home, quite a lot of alarm for British people in Lebanon as well.
Israeli tanks are reported to be gathering near the country's border with Lebanon, suggesting an invasion could be imminent. Hezbollah's deputy leader says it's ready for any Israeli ground offensive. Naim Qassem says the battle may be long. 4 Metropolitan Police officers and a member of staff will be disciplined over the handling of allegations against the serial rapist David Carrick. The former officer was jailed for at least 30 years in February last year. Experts are appealing for people to come forward if they think their relatives could have been buried at a mother and baby home in Ireland. The nuns who ran the home at Tuam in County Galway between the 1920s and 60s disposed of up to 796 babies and young children in a disused sewage tank. It's a significant day for coal power in the UK. Tata Steel is shutting down its coal-fired blast furnace at Port Talbot, the last one in the UK. Thousands of jobs are being lost at the site. And the final ever coal-fired power station is closing down in Nottinghamshire as well. Mary Weston Abbey lives nearby.
When we get the steam coming off the chimneys and mixing with the clouds and things, there are some stunning sunsets, sunrises, beautiful photos of it. So, yeah, it does seem silly to be attached to it, but, yeah, it will be very sad when it goes.
Mary Weston Webb there. Naga will have more from the Port Talbot site in the next half hour. The BBC's discovered that McDonald's failed to stop the exploitation of 9 men who'd been trafficked to the UK from the Czech Republic and forced to work in one of its branches. McDonald's says it's taken action to help detect potential risks and says it's committed to helping every employee spot warning signs. And passengers on a ship which has been stuck in Belfast since the end of May are hoping to finally start their round-the-world cruise later. The